This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Shahid Abari. Welcome to BBC Radio 3's Arts and Ideas discussion programme, which brings together leading artists, writers and thinkers in conversation and debate. If you enjoy what you hear, do subscribe. Search for the Arts and Ideas podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please rate and review us. It'll help other people find us too.
This is the BBC.
Hello. Have nothing in your house that you do not know to be useful or believe to be beautiful, declared the radical Victorian designer William Morris. And beauty and utility were also the principles of mid-century modern design. In today's programme, we discuss the artists and illustrators who literally designed the fabric of post-war Britain, and we reflect on the legacy of Charles Rennie Mackintosh, 150 years after his birth. If all that makes you want to settle into an elegant Ames chair with your feet up on a G-plan table, spare a thought for us collectors of cast-offs and bric-a-brac. New generation thinker Lisa Mullen examines junk shop gothic, the uncanny life of inanimate objects. We dusted Lisa off and sent her to the V&A too to find out about utopian technologies at their show, The Future Starts Here. We're starting with the past, though, because the question of how to design useful and beautiful things in an age of technological transformation was also one that preoccupied artists Edward Borden and Enid Marx in the early 20th century. Their work emerged just as the machines of mass production had begun to blur the boundary between art and industry.
I came into the last great fling of printing. Marvellous times to live in. In those days, one drew one's illustrations with a certain degree of craftsmanship, because working for the colour line block, I had to do black drawings of every colour. There might be six colours. They might not fit. If they didn't fit, that was my responsibility. Now, of course, you can reproduce anything. It's a mug's game.
Edward Borden there, reflecting in 1982 on the relationship of design and technology. Borden was a watercolourist and illustrator and commercial designer. His undulating lines and graphic style are riposte to angular modernist abstraction. Enid Marx was an illustrator and prolific printmaker, designing stamps, wrapping paper and Christmas cards. She's most famous, though, for the bold block patterns that would become the indefatigably durable upholstery of the London Underground. James Russell is curating an exhibition of Borden's work at the Dulwich Picture Gallery, and Alan Powers is co-curator of a show about Marx at the House of Illustration in London. James, perhaps you could start by giving us a sense of Edward Borden's style and his range.
The first word that springs to mind with Borden is Baroque. He was a wild man of design, I think. He went all over the place. He had influences from all over the world, all through history, and his work is always full of vigour, life, movement.
And what made him stand out from his contemporaries?
You never knew what he was going to come up with. His imagination was endless. He was a fabulist. He created all kinds of creatures and worlds. He was interested in everything, really. Anything that he thought would make an interesting picture or design. Victoriana absolutely loved it, collected guardsmen's jackets and all that sort of stuff. But when asked to draw the new penguin pool at London Zoo, he had fun with the lines that produced. So I don't think he was particularly prejudiced one way or the other.
Alan, how would you describe Enid Marx's style and the influences visible in her work?
She studied painting alongside Borden, and they failed her in her diploma because she was either too abstract or too modern or both. Whether she took this lesson to heart, anyway, she didn't pursue a career in painting, although she was a printmaker and she was always drawing. She started her design career making her own textiles with block printing, a craft technique which she learnt for 2 years. And then already she'd become famous at a very early age, as indeed Borden was too. And critics praised these fabrics very highly.
And you knew her personally as well. What was she like, and did she talk to you about her work?
She was interested in everything and everybody. Her own work she enjoyed talking about, but not to excess. She was very young at heart, and great fun.
Some of her patterns feel modern and abstract. You get waves and blocks and those dissected circles. And then at other times, she's using natural dyes and textiles. Did she identify with the modern art movement or with a more traditional sense of craft?
She probably wouldn't have made a distinction between them. There was a job to do, there was a technique appropriate for it, and that's how she worked. She, in a way, was most modern at the beginning and moved in a sort of wave motion up and down on that. I don't think temperamentally she was really part of maybe what you're thinking about as modern, which is blank and empty looking, because she loved pattern and loved to fill up a field with marks of some kind. Marks.
Those London Transport maquettes, they instantly bring to mind something very recognisable, those interlocked chevrons and these endlessly iterated patterns in clashing colours. Did she recognise that that commission was an opportunity to design something that would have a huge impact?
Well, she would never have liked the word clashing, because one of her principles when designing them was that they should be stimulating but ultimately restful.
Right.
They shouldn't make you feel sick. She says that they started off under the direction of Christian Barman, who was basically commissioning them, with rather dull colours because they thought those would wear better. And then they had a change of heart and did them in green and red mainly, which were sort of house colours for London Underground.
Did they both Marx and Borden, regard their commercial work as fine art for them?
Borden saw no distinction between the two. He did say at one point the only difference between fine art and commercial work was fine art was movable, and so dealers called it fine art so they could sell it.
Marx was commercially successful in this period. Was she critically successful?
Most of the time she had a critical success. It all sort of fades slightly after the war, it has to be said. She was doing interesting work, but somehow she didn't quite hit the spot in the way she had before. The stamps she did were perhaps an exception to that. She did the what are called the definitives for the present queen, the low-value stamps that everybody used with a sort of garland of flowers going around her photographic head.
Yes.
And some Christmas ones much later on in the 1970s.
I know that Marx was printing from woodcut blocks and that Borden was experimenting with linocut, wielding these enormous rubber stamps. How technically innovative were they?
In Borden's case, he invented a new art form, really. I mean, linocut had been used by the German Expressionists, and Claude Flight brought them into use in England in the 20s. But no one had done anything like his large-scale lino cuts. I don't think they have since either. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But I think he did it because his watercolours had slipped out of fashion. A lot of that generation found that post-war they were no longer so relevant. And what Borden did is he kept reinventing himself. He did it over and over again, managed to remain relevant, pushed himself to take on new challenges, of which lino cut was one. There's a marvellous old BBC film from the Monitor series in which you can see him making Linsell Church, one of his most famous lino cuts, in which he lays a block on the floor and then walks up and down on the paper.
Wow.
To make the print. Extraordinary.
This is very hands-on. Is it the same for Marx, that there was technical innovation in her work?
When she was doing lino cuts, some of them are quite like Borden's, sort of sharp-edged and interesting colour overlays. I think she used more water-based inks than he did. His oil, I fancy. And then she did another series, which are less well-known, where they're more like monoprints. She kind of combed or textured the surface of the ink on the paper before she printed it, and each impression is different. So that was her sort of area of innovation, I think.
Yeah, and Borden, you mentioned earlier, James, was also a war artist, of course. He'd been appointed by Kenneth Clark's War Artists Advisory Committee during the Second World War. What did he see? Where did he go? And how did he report it?
Borden, quite famously, had been to very few places in the 1930s. He was mostly happy to be in Great Barfield in Essex. When he was made a war artist, he was sent to northern France, first of all. And he said later, I had to learn how to become a journalist, because he had to record events very quickly. He came back from Dunkirk. And then he was sent to Cairo, Egypt, and spent 5 years on what he called a cook's tour, travelling all around North Africa, all around the Middle East, crossing the Saudi Arabian desert, spent a year or two in Iraq, in Baghdad, visited the Marsh Arabs, and everywhere he went, he painted topographical watercolours and portraits, something he'd never done before. He'd always been told he couldn't draw people, and so he kind of took that criticism on board. He started drawing troops of different nationalities in Africa, and it's kind of a highlight of the exhibition, actually. We have a room of these portraits, which are just, they're remarkable.
They're very truthful and dispassionate without being sentimental as well. I mean, there's a watercolour of the refugees in an Italian village, and they're clustering together, and some of them are prone, and they're polemical, but they're also very truthful without being...
He didn't have a sentimental bone in his body, Borden. Mm. He was very kind of clear-eyed. As I said, he had a marvellous sense of humour, so even in his war pictures, sometimes you'll see little... You know, he was a great pal of Edward Ardizzone, and they kind of... Carouse isn't the right word, but they sort of went to see the sights in Rome together and so forth. And there's always, as with Ardizzone, there's always a little bit of humour to leaven the seriousness.
Yes. I did quote William Morris earlier, the beautiful and the useful, and that's a sentiment that's underpinned by Morris's socialism, of course. Do you think there's a similar social principle at work in Borden and Marx, in the idea that everybody should have access to beautifully designed things?
Speaking for Marx, what she did during the war was quite a lot of children's books, a new departure for her, and the utility furnishing fabrics. She was put onto the utility furniture committee, and being on this committee under the Board of Trade, she realised that there was nobody designing anything. It just went to the manufacturers, who were told what they could and couldn't do. So she stepped in and started designing patterns. She saw this as a great opportunity to raise standards of taste, but at the same time she did go and ask people, the kind of people who'd been bombed out, who were going to get these fabrics, what they would like. And they said, we'd like something jolly. And so that's how she did it, within the limitations, quite severe limitations of what was available.
The utility furniture, people sit on seats, and of course they hold book jackets and they read maps. Were Borden and Marx thinking about how commercial design would establish a different kind of relationship between artists and users?
I'm not sure that Borden spent much time thinking about those sorts of questions. And similarly, your previous question about the kind of social use of his work. One thing, when he was making the portraits, he did take great pains to identify people, and I think it was very important. And one of them even has the army number of the soldier written on the front of the watercolour. So he obviously felt it was important that these particular people were remembered, and they were generally quite humble people. Mm. And he was a lifelong Labour Party member. But in terms of his design, I think he was always trying to fulfil every commission as best he could and do the best work he could. But beyond that, I'm not sure that he had that sort of principle.
Marx wanted to improve people's taste, and the market wasn't always ready for it. And there are a lot of sad stories where manufacturers came to her and she said, this is how I work, this is what I have to be paid. And they said, sorry, we wouldn't be able to sell your things, and we can't do it. There's the whole sort of oddity, in a way. I think it's faded out rather now, but through most of the 20th century, people were doing what Gordon Russell, who was her friend and chaired the utility committee, called pushing the tank uphill. There was this heavy object and there was this resistance to it, and everybody had to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and in a sense it never got to the top of the hill. And we've kind of let it slip back down again. We don't worry in that way anymore, and I think that's probably more sensible. But she was very much one of those people joining in the pushing.
Yes. I think there seemed to me that there was an idea that commerce and industry were an opportunity for good design, an opportunity for good design. And it seemed to me the opposite of that kind of John Ruskinish lament about industrialisation and the loss of local crafts. And do you think, in the end, Borden and Marx were optimistic about the place of art and design in an industrial and commercial age?
Well, I think Borden obviously relished having the work when he was given the opportunity to do I don't know, advertisements for Shell and that kind of thing. They were part of the commercial world. And I think he certainly felt there was a value in producing excellent work which would then be seen by people. You could have probably seen an example of his work every day of your life, just in newspapers, magazines, billboards. It was everywhere.
Marx got kind of anxious and worried about the state of things. And so one would get these phone calls saying, we've got to do something about. One of them I had once was, Alan, it's Marco here. I want to shoot the director of the V&A. Will you come and have tea? And there was always humour in it, but there was a lot of passion as well. Why isn't the National Trust selling locally made objects in its shops? We've got to do something about that. Why is the Royal College of Art thinking that they're going to separate design and fine art? Mm. These sort of things mattered enormously. I think she possibly missed some of what was going on, particularly in the 60s, when the pop art revolution, the sort of Carnaby Street styles, were full of the things she really liked, colour and pattern and richness, and not at all like what modernism had been in the 30s for most people. The other thing that needs mentioning is popular art, as she and her friend Margaret Lambert called it, which they collected and wrote books about, which was essentially from the 19th century. It was cheap objects, ceramics, glass, textiles, and so on, in a sort of folk art style, but produced industrially. And she felt they got it right back then by going with the flow of what people were interested in, allowing a sort of natural, naive charm to come into it. And that, I think, she felt was always missing somewhat. So she was very keen the collection should be shown in public, that there really should be a national museum for this kind of thing, which there still isn't. But at least the collection got to Compton Verney House in Warwickshire, where it's on permanent display, and it's one of the most popular things there.
Thank you, James and Alan. Do stay with us, because I think we'll call on your good taste and keen eye again in a moment. If you've ever wandered through the Glasgow School of Art or stopped for a tea cake at the Willow Tea Rooms off Socky Hall Street, then you'll instantly recognise Charles Rennie Mackintosh's brand of baronial Scottish architecture and European Art Nouveau style. Born in 1868, he was an architect with a passion for interiors, as attentive to teaspoons as to embossed exteriors. This year marks the 150th anniversary of his birth. Design historian Eleanor Herring is on the line to talk us through his work. Eleanor, when we say Mackintosh style, we mean buildings, but also an array of fine and decorative arts, jewellery, textiles, ceramics, metalwork. What are the distinguishing characteristics of his work, would you say?
Well, you're right. He worked across different mediums. We tend to think of his architecture, his buildings, as you mentioned, Glasgow School of Art, the Hill House, the tea rooms. But he designed chairs, he designed teaspoons, wallpaper, textiles, all sorts of things. I think what makes his work so distinctive is that he's difficult to pin down. I mean, some scholars have attributed his work to Art Nouveau, to arts and crafts. Some people would argue that he was, a proto-modernist. He can fit within the context of Art Deco. But really, he's an individual. He was a lunatic in some respects, in terms of what he did. In terms of influences, he looked to the Scottish vernacular, particularly medieval styles of Scotland, but also to Japan. And I think you can see that in his work, the sense that you have an interest in nature, but nature never really gets a free pass. It's always contained.
Manicured.
Within this strict structural framework.
Do you think he thought of himself as an architect or an artist or as a designer?
I think, again, he kind of resists containment in any one of those categories. I mean, he was an architect. He worked for Honeyman and Kepi. But I think he was an architect who had a secret fantasy to be an artist. Mm-hmm. Photographs of him in the architectural practice, he looks like any other, middle-class professional with a strict, a straightforward haircut and a tight tie. But other photographs of him, you see more floppy hair and a floppy tie. He has a fantasy about being an artist, too.
And it's a very complete vision of the work, a total body of work, right?
Yeah, this German word, Gesamtkunstwerk, I think is a good one to use with McIntosh. He really was a total designer. He tried to design every single aspect of a project. So with the tea rooms, for example, when he was commissioned by Catherine Cranston to design tea rooms for Glasgow, you know, he didn't just design the interiors and the furniture. He designed the teaspoons. He designed the uniforms that the staff were wearing. So he was probably quite a difficult professional to employ in some respects, because you had to be prepared to lay yourself bare to everything that he had to propose.
It's curious because he's so often associated very freely, I think, with those lead-panelled windows and those severe tall-backed chairs. Mm. Do you think there are aspects of his work that are sort of under-regarded?
I think since the 80s, he's been extremely popular. We see him everywhere, particularly in Scotland, and I say this also as an alumni of Glasgow School of Art. You are surrounded by McIntosh. So it's hard to say what has been under-regarded or, you know, what we don't think of typically as being McIntosh. But I think, you know, the interiors that you mentioned, those dark interiors and the dark furniture, you also have this contrast with McIntosh, which is these lovely, beautiful, light spaces, blindingly light. And that's a contrast, I think, which isn't necessarily in conflict with McIntosh. It's a negotiation constantly between the light and the dark, the sensual and the symbolic.
It's interesting you're talking about the sensual, because we've been talking about the contribution that Enid Marx made to modern design. We might think similarly of Margaret MacDonald, McIntosh's wife, who was an accomplished artist in her own right. What was her role in the emergence of the Glasgow School style?
She was a collaborator with McIntosh. I think historians, design and architectural historians, have in the past written her out as a sort of inferior presence, you know, someone like Morton Shand or Pevsner, even in their histories of the pioneers of the modern movement, really disregarded Margaret MacDonald's influence upon McIntosh because of her interest in symbolism. They attributed her to more sort of decorative instincts. And I think that's something that scholars of McIntosh are trying to address, that she wasn't just somebody who was operating separately. She did work very closely with McIntosh. McIntosh himself, you know, wasn't one for writing very much, but we do know from his writings that he attributed a lot of his work to his wife, Margaret, and that they worked as a partnership.
I think I read somewhere that he said, "Margaret has genius, I have only talent," which is a rather nice way of putting it.
Indeed.
McIntosh had such an enduring impact on the design history of Glasgow. This seems like a good moment to draw you, Alan, and James back into this conversation. I wonder how far you think these artists were concerned with an idea of civic design as a kind of social good affecting the day-to-day lives of ordinary people in a city.
The answer must be yes. It was a very widespread movement at that time, and it's to do really with coming out of the kind of dark phase of the Industrial Revolution and realising that a lot of mistakes had been made, but things could be put right because they'd made the money and could afford to do it.
It's interesting when you think of Borden and his murals, very few of which have survived. But there is one, actually, Chelsea and Kensington Hotel. There's a lovely mural that he originally made for BP, Fantasy on Islamic Architecture. And you can definitely get the sense with him that he wanted to fill a space, to kind of conjure an image within a space for the pleasure of the people working there or eating there or whatever it was. So in that sense, yes, I suppose he must have.
Thank you. You're listening to Free Thinking with me, Shahida Bari. If you'd like to hear more about art and design, you can explore other programmes in our archive, including discussions about textile art, the influence of Scandinavian design, and the challenges of building megastructures. Details are available on bbc.co.uk/freethinking, and you can find us by searching for Arts and Ideas wherever you get your podcasts. Now, from Buzz Lightyear to Balzac, we've been thinking about the personalities behind beautifully designed objects. But what if objects possessed personalities of their own? In the latest of our columns from the 2018 New Generation Thinkers, Lisa Mullen from the University of Oxford confronts the spectre of junk shop gothic.
When I was a child, I desperately wanted to be Emily, the girl in the BBC series Bagpuss. Emily brought old toys to a magic junk shop, where they would mend themselves mysteriously when human backs were turned. It was pretty clear to me that Emily was an idiot, because she didn't seem to realise that all these objects were really alive, that they were secretly singing and dancing and squabbling and making plans. But I would know. I felt sure that I would get much more out of the experience than Emily. Later, when I had a child of my own, it occurred to me that Pixar's Toy Story films work on a similar principle. Discarded toys get mixed up in human transactions, which mistake them for obedient commodities, when really they're plotting amongst themselves in private. Later still, when I wrote a PhD and then a book about uncanny objects, I came to understand that both these children's classics tap into a deep cultural reservoir of stories about haunted shops where dangerous bargains are made. In The Wild Ass's Skin, Honoré de Balzac pictured a gothic emporium where you could buy a piece of old leather that granted wishes, the snag being that it would cut years off your life for every desire fulfilled. M.R. James favoured tales of antiquarians who purchased old manuscripts and pictures only to discover they were haunted by ancient demons. My favourite is Marguerite Lasky's post-war novella The Victorian Chaise Longue, in which a posh and pampered woman buys a scruffy couch as a piece of amusing kitsch, but finds herself transported back through time when she lies down on it and falls asleep. In George Orwell's dystopian vision of 1984, it's a junk shop which finishes off the desperate would-be rebel Winston Smith. Winston has been looking for old objects which might contain the cultural memory that has been erased by the Big Brother revolution. And he thinks he's found what he wants in a paperweight with a piece of coral embedded in the glass. But like the coral, Winston is caught in a trap. He rents the junk shop's upstairs room as a secret hideaway, but the thought police are really watching the whole time, and when armed goons swoop in to arrest him, the paperweight is smashed, and the entrancing piece of coral, like Winston's rebellion, is exposed as a pathetic scrap of meaningless rubbish. Like the glass of the paperweight, junk shop gothic is a magnifying lens which reveals the secret life of things. A certain kind of looking is required of the junk hunter, a concentrated, focused participation. What you buy in these haunted shops is always deeply personal. It's up to you to battle past all the stuff you don't want to get to the one thing you really, really need. Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud both warned in different ways against over-investing in material objects. For Marx, their solidity disguised the slippery fictions underpinning capitalism. Freud thought that our lust for special objects might disconnect us from our true desires. But are we ever in full control of the objects we unleash into the world? Things which have their own history, their own agenda, maybe their own instinct to survive? Upcycling old stuff puts a deceptive gloss of sustainability on our shopping habits. But stories about magic junk shops warn us that our addiction to consumption may not be so easily neutralised. These days, with waves of disobedient plastic circling the globe and fatbergs of our waste prowling the sewers beneath our feet, I'm wondering if Emily was onto something after all. Maybe she was right to close the door of the magic junk shop and walk away.
Thank you, Lisa. What's so special about the space of the junk shop, and have they changed over time?
A junk shop's like a portal into another world. You sort of feel like you've stepped off the map somehow and found yourself in an alternative universe. But I think it's probably fair to say that junk shops have changed in recent times. In fact, I think they probably changed around the time of World War II. In fact, if you start looking back, you'll find lots of newspaper articles around that time of people mourning the loss of the real junk shops that were just higgledy-piggledy messes. Now they find them presided over by these scary, glossy women wearing slacks, of all things, and beads. And they've sort of beginning to invent something called retro style, which is different from the sort of accidental flotsam and jetsam which supposedly would arrive
by accident in a traditional junk shop.
That's the junk shop I recognise, a junk shop that's become rather fashionable, a scavenging ground for vintage chic and a kind of elegant slumming look. Yeah. Have they always been fluid sites in terms of class and taste?
Yes, I think when this kind of retro style thing started to happen, in a way, I think it was a sort of reaction against World War II and utility furniture, which we were just talking about in relation to Enid Marx. I think people didn't necessarily like this very plain style of furniture that they were forced to buy during the war. So they started to turn to old objects and old furniture as having this indefinable quality called character. And of course, once you start to make these things fashionable, then you get the taste police getting involved, and then it becomes a question of class and money. And those kinds of things start to creep in, and gentrification, which is one of the interesting things about Marguerite Lasky's novella, The Victorian Chaise Longue. The main character in that is a sort of pioneer gentrifier. She's bought this old house in a very unfashionable part of Islington, if you can imagine such a thing existing. And she wants to fill it with kind of ironic junk, just to prove how edgy she is. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the ghost story that develops is partly about the clash between history and modernity, but it's also about muddling up the distinctions between different classes and how that might be dangerous territory.
Alan and James, are you ardent riflers in junk shops? Have you ever found an Enid Marx buried away in an antique shop somewhere or a second-hand shop?
Well, not literally, but I collect a lot of the same sort of things that she collected and have done for years and can't stop.
The artists of that period that we were talking about, Enid Marx, Borden, Revilius and co, they loved junk shops, and they loved what they called junking, i.e. rifling through junk shops, finding choice, interesting objects that they loved. Yes, I do love a junk shop.
I'm a junk shop person too. I've got a rotary phone at home, and it takes me 10 minutes to dial a number out. So, Lisa, tell me, what is the allure of a vintage object? Why am I using this phone?
Well, I also, you know, do like old stuff, and I buy a lot of things on eBay. I've got a house full of eBay furniture. And I like to tell myself it's because I'm buying something solid, it's past the test of time and it's not going to fall apart like a flat pack. But there's also a sort of glamour to the old object. These are kind of time travellers. They've passed beyond the human realm into some other kind of world. They haven't done it by magic, really. They've just done it by surviving. There's a kind of fluidity of value which you find in a junk shop, that one person's junk is another person's treasure. And there's something very interesting about how that can change almost overnight and something just becomes reappreciated. It's in the eye of the beholder, really.
Mm. You and I both went along to the new show at the Victorian Albert Museum here in London called The Future Starts Here, which is about the opposite of my rotary phone. It's about Facebook-branded solar satellites and a laundry robot, a driverless car. It's been pitched as an exhibition exploring the power of design in shaping the world of tomorrow. What does the world of tomorrow look like to you, having been to this exhibition, Lisa?
It's a rather confusing place, to be fair. It's a very mixed up kind of exhibition. It describes a future that's quite corporate and very technological. It seems to me that there isn't much room for the human. There are occasional objects which seem to refer to humanity. There's an architectural model that was built by a 13-year-old boy in Aleppo, which is quite rough around the edges, and it's obviously been made by a child, but it's a sort of oasis of humanity in this otherwise very glossy, very kind of neon world. And it's interesting that that was one of the objects that I found really memorable when I came out.
Yes, that object is very arresting. I also noticed the hands-free microcomputer that reports on the efficiency of workers to Amazon. Yes. There are ethical questions about how design relates to its society, aren't there?
Absolutely. There's the idea that if we can just sort of hack ourselves, that we can become more and more efficient and more economically viable as, you know, kind of components in this machine. And I'm not sure that's really what we want to be. There's something quite disturbing about that. I sort of noticed that they were giving out free samples of this drink called Soylent, which I think is named after a film called Soylent Green, which is from the 1973, right. Charlton Heston film. It's a ridiculous dystopia kind of bit of nonsense, really. But the main twist at the end is that this artificial food that they're giving out in this overpopulated world is actually made out of dead corpses. And
that wasn't what we drank when we tried that sample.
No, I'm pretty sure it was just a sort of chocolate milkshake with added vitamins or something in it. But it's odd that what started off as a sort of dystopian idea, that people would have to conform to this machinic idea of capitalism, that's now become a utopian ideal, that we are willingly participating in our own, you know, dehumanisation.
Alan, you went to the show as well, didn't you?
Yes. Yes, I have a ticket to prove it, which is handwritten, and it says, "Printer didn't work. Please admit one to Future Starts here."
That speaks volumes, of course.
That's the future I want, where things don't quite work. That would suit me fine. But actually, I'm glad the V&A's done it. This sort of thing needs to happen often. I'm glad it represents the green movement, which actually needs its own museum or permanent display space, which it doesn't have, because that is where technology and very low tech in some cases is happening in all sorts of ways, and people need to know about this now, and they're not getting the information.
Well, Eleanor, maybe I can draw you back in here, because the show, as Alan points out, does raise these conscientious questions about sustainability. And, of course, you're a design historian. Mm. If this is the age of the Anthropocene, as people are fond of saying, in which, you know, humans have demonstrably altered the Earth, should we start to think of the planet now as a kind of design challenge which we have to resolve?
I think designers are doing that. My concern sometimes with sustainability is that, you know, we can talk about it, but actually how do we put these ideas into practice? It seems to me that, you know, going back to some of the examples we talked about earlier, the discourse of good design, you know, and what that means, sustainability is slotted quite nicely in there. It's the same language that we're using. And I think with any kind of discourse, you need to ask, well, who is this benefiting? Who's accountable? How transparent are these decisions? I don't often get that feeling with design.
Mm. Some of the objects in the show, Lisa, are trying to address us. You were talking about uncanny objects. Mm. There's a bathroom mirror in the show that tries to read your emotions when you look into it, like a horribly perverse fairy tale. It didn't work, but I wanted it to.
Right,
why?
Yes.
Why do we want objects to be smart? Why do we want them to know us better than we know ourselves?
I know. I'm not sure that we necessarily do. I think people think that that's a good way of saying them to us. But I think that there's always the sense of the uncanny valley if something comes too close to us. We're not sure, actually, whether we want that. It's interesting that there are a couple of old objects in the exhibition. There is a reliquary, which is in the shape of a hand, a sort of silver hand that's designed to hold the bones of saints or something, little pieces of bone within the fingers. And that's an incredibly uncanny object in itself. And I'm not quite sure what it's doing in the exhibition, but I think if it's doing anything, it's reminding us that there is always something of death and kind of decay in all these ideas of the future. They become superannuated very quickly.
And James and Alan, utopias, they often have a nostalgic quality. Even the ways that we imagine the future with aluminium panels and neon lights, that can feel retro, right? It can feel
old. Yes, you're so right. The future hasn't changed for 100 years. it still looks the same. And, you know, we've lived through all this, and that isn't the world that most of us want to live in. We don't want it to look like that. It may work in different ways, but looking is another thing entirely.
The whole experience of the exhibition really reminded me of reading about the Festival of Britain in 1951, which was again all about a vision of the future
and the
dome
past.
And the past. But it reminded me of the Dome of Discovery. It had the same sense of a sort of hodgepodge of objects which were supposedly designed to tell a story about the future and be coherent, but in fact just became a bit incomprehensible, and people had to find their own way through. And people get distracted by their own sort of sense of what they think is fun. There's a story about Winston Churchill going to the opening and becoming obsessed with an escalator. There's a massive escalator in the middle of the Dome of Discovery.
Very distracting.
Yes, and he was having so much fun riding up and down on it, like a child on a slide, that he had to be dragged away so that he could be shown all the proper stuff. But he was just, you know, no, I want to do the escalator again.
One of the designers who worked on it called it the Elephant's Graveyard.
Right, yes, yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Festival of Britain, because I wondered, Alan, if you detected a kind of residual mid-centuryness in ultra-contemporary design like that showcased at the V&A.
Well, I think there's always been a kind of side stream, if you like, in design represented, say, by Buckminster Fuller, which deals with technological visions of the future, and there are always people keen on that. And then there's other people getting on with something now. It's a simplification, but I think it's a bit like that.
And there's always been a sort of, and I think of it as a sort of Baroque strain of inventiveness that runs through the 20th century in parallel with all the developments of what we call modernism. Mm. And the Festival of Britain is a classic example where they were presenting people with brutalist architecture or very modern architecture that they hadn't seen before. But at the same time, there were gigantic corn dollies and sort of all kinds of much older things that people, as Alan said, were making then, but which weren't seen by the moderns as being relevant.
Mm. I wonder if you feel like this kind of retro revival is a kind of return to texture and palette of the mid-century, precisely because contemporary design has a textureless sheen like an iPhone, or it has a colourless glaze, as though it's compensating for something that we've lost in contemporary design.
I think one thing is that the whole digital world, the computer world, the fact that we're looking at a screen all the time, has opened up a huge kind of market for design and graphic design and different styles and so forth. And so you can put anything on a screen, and those graphic works, like a Borden piece, looks fantastic on a screen. So it's a good fit in that sense.
And those book jackets are just timeless, aren't they? They're still so infinitely desirable, I think. Eleanor, what do you think?
I just was thinking there that there's something... Well, there's lots to say, but one of the things I would say is that often I think this harking back to the past, there's something about the weight of objects from the past. When you hold them in your hand, when you feel, if you're pressing a button, rather than, you know, just hovering your finger over this button and, you know, the phone or whatever it is switches on, there's something really satisfying about pressing a button, the way that it accommodates your body. And that's something which I think new designs need to remember, that people actually want those sensory, that sort of sensory relationship with objects. You know, digital technology, all these kind of new technologies coming in, there's also something to remember about technology from the past, that actually maybe that's what the consumer wants, that physical relationship with an object.
Is it still possible for contemporary artists and designers to engage with audiences in this way, in the face of enormous corporations and multinational businesses, in the way that Borden and Marx and Macintosh were doing?
I think there's always a need for people to make things that look good in different ways, and graphic design, you know, in one sense, people's homes, interiors. You walk into shops and there's so much kind of particularly mid-century style design work from all kinds of interior stuff, and that isn't going to go away.
It's possible to live in those two worlds simultaneously, and a lot of people do very effectively. If you think of Charles and Ray Eames doing those very sleek chairs, and then their house and their films and books are full of junk. Lovely, well-selected, carefully thought-out, beautiful junk.
Yes. It's interesting, isn't it, when junk becomes aestheticised in that way. It's taken out of its sort of, you know, out of its element as junk and placed into a very fashionable or very curated environment, and it changes its character at that stage. It's interesting how one object can mean different things to different people.
Eleanor, junk or treasure?
Well, with Macintosh, it has been junk. It's been thrown into the skip and discarded over the years. It's been sold at auction for thousands of pounds. I think Macintosh straddles both these camps. And if you want a mainstream example, you know, you can buy yourself a Macintosh teapot or, you know, tea towel or earrings. The Scottish souvenir market, I think, must be delighted to have Macintosh in its book.
The best kind of Mac to buy, I think.
Thanks
to my guests. Details of all the exhibitions we've been discussing can be found on our website. Tomorrow, Philip Dodd talks to clinical psychologist and cultural critic Jordan B. Peterson. But now it's time for my producer Torquil MacLeod and me to recline on our Robin Day chairs as the Aula Keary curtain falls on free thinking. Goodbye. Thanks for listening. You can find more from our archives and further information about the guests and topics discussed by looking up the Freethinking programme website on BBC Radio 3. If we've whetted your appetite for more discussions about arts and ideas, you might be interested in other BBC podcasts. Start the Week, Thinking Aloud and In Our Time. Or if you prefer talks, search out Radio 3's The Essay.